Well, thank you for coming to this panel today. I'm pleased to be here. This has been a 9-year journey. And really, I think there's a book deal at the end of this, because the story behind this particular piece of the healthcare reform legislation and the twists and turns that it's taken over the last particularly 3 years has been quite interesting. I just want to give a few points on first the policy, and then I think come around to the politics, because that's really where we are right now today. And I'm going to come from a different frame of reference, because for me this is not about academia. It's about what happens to real people in neighborhoods. I am still a practicing pediatric and neonatal nurse practitioner. My master's happens to be in long-term care. But interestingly, even when I went to school to get my master's in nursing in long-term care, I had to fight with the dean of Penn, University of Penn, where I went, because I wanted to do long-term care of kids with cardiopulmonary and neurologic disorders. And all I heard was, no, long-term care is for the aging population. It's not for kids, it's for the aging population. We went back and forth and back and forth. And so that did have a little bit of thinking that went into it when we've done the last one, when I was with Senator Kennedy, and we did the last two pieces of legislation, one called Family Opportunity Act, which is actually the availability for families that had children with significant disabilities not to have to stay poor, not to have to stay in significant need in order to get the services for their children, and this happened to be the next piece after that. Historically, quickly, this was a priority for Senator Kennedy in health care reform. His son actually testified to that matter last week up on Capitol Hill. The reason this was important to him and the reason it was in the healthcare to begin with from his perspective was because he was a true believer that you can't reform the healthcare system unless you give people what they need to maintain their function and prevent them from slipping backwards. Now, any of you that work in actual healthcare with real people, I think you understand that we can do everything we can to keep people healthy, to really help them get out of an unhealthy state into a healthy state, but if that is not maintained, they are back and back in the front end of the healthcare system. And for the weekends that I cover sometimes the emergency room as a practitioner, three kinds of people come in: people that need ER care, people who need primary care, and we turn them around and send them to a doc in the box because they don't have primary care. And the third group, which is the largest, I saw this in Philadelphia's downtown hospitals as well as here, the third group are people who have underlying conditions that, had they been maintained, would not be back in the front end of the healthcare system over and over. So that was the reason that it was in healthcare reform. The structure of the bill was designed in 2003, so the structure had absolutely nothing to do with the financing of health care reform, absolutely nothing. When we did it, we actually had surveyed young people because we wanted this particular program to be number one voluntary. We actually didn't want it to be voluntary. We actually wanted it to be a voluntary opt-out program like a lot of the 401k programs are. Wanted to be that. And there are almost 13 voluntary opt-out programs in this country, all the way from some things in healthcare to the fact that if you have a junior in high school, all of their personally identifiable information is sent to the Army recruiter unless you opt out of it. So there are lots of opt-out programs in this country that range not just in healthcare but across the continuum of human services. So we thought, well, that's a reasonable thing to do as a voluntary opt-out program. We wanted it to be a cash model, and the reason is because we did a survey of almost 2,200 students across the country, 18 to 22 years old, and we had focus groups with them. And a few things came out of it. One was, do you care about this issue at all? And it was fun for me because I have 7 kids, and 4 of my boys play baseball. One plays professional ball, the rest are in college playing ball. And so they think they're invincible. So I was really, yet they're not, probably more than anybody. And so it was interesting for us to do the college campuses. And what we found from these focus groups was really unusual to me. And it was that the young people, 18 to 22, had much more of an appreciation that they don't know who they're going to be 24 hours from now than I would argue I ever had. What's the reason? Had more kids in special ed in their classes, more boogie board accidents, more car accidents. They really did have much more of an appreciation. This is the same group that now contributes to 401ks once they very first get out of school. I would argue I didn't start doing that until I was 40. So those are the kinds of things that we found with the students. The second thing was, do you believe it's worth it to even be in this kind of a program? And I think your data may support some of this. And they said yes, as long as the premium wasn't very high. Well, what's a reasonable premium? $30 a month. So if you go back and look at the original bill that we introduced, it was a voluntary opt-out. It was a cash model, because that was the third thing the young people said. You know, what kind of program should this be? Should it be like traditional, very traditional long-term care insurance? Should it be a mix like they do in the European countries? They said cash, so that it works for me if I fall off a ski lift. It works for my grandmom if she needs something in our house. The other thing they reported was when they went home at Christmas and the holidays, that the conversation in their home was, what are we going to do about grandma? So it was almost generationally the conversation lined up. So we had almost 95% of the 2,200 students that were surveyed say, yes, we would do it if the premium was low enough. The next group of people that we surveyed that I still go out and talk to a lot are the PTAs, parent teacher associations. When you're in a room with them and you talk about No Child Left Behind, but you say to them, what are you going to do when your 22-year-old jumps off the deck at beach week into 2 feet of water, and that is a phone call to home at 3 o'clock in the morning? Okay, they haven't worked the 10 years to be able to get the disability insurance that you contribute on the back of your paycheck. That is a phone call to families who are right in the midst of a very decreased 401k of their own retirement because of the economy. You can hear a pin drop in the room. People will come up afterwards and say, well, can we pay the premium? We said, absolutely, you can pay the premium. So this notion that came around this bill that was based on, and this is one of the reasons I think we have trouble with it, this notion that you can't do a program that's a cash model, you can't do a program like this because you won't get enough participation of healthy people is based on the assumptions of the current long-term care insurance industry that already is in their own death spiral at only being able to penetrate 2% of the marketplace. So when you're stuck, as we were, with the assumptions, because it was the only experience data that was out there to put onto this program, we already started behind the eight ball. This is not the same as long-term care insurance. It was not intended to be. It's not the be-all, end-all. It's meant to give people who have functional limitations, under 65 or over 65, that are working, the ability to be brought to equal to continue to have a life. Okay, this isn't like disability insurance where your check stops the minute you go back to work. That's not what this is. And it's not long-term care insurance in the traditional way that it's been marketed over the years. This was a different animal, and so different than when we actually wrote it and sat with it, we said, we're not putting a program in here. So if you look at the Class Act language, there is no program there. This is what's fascinating when we watch the conversation about let's repeal the programs, not what program. There is no program in that bill designed. What we did was give parameters to work with to the HHS, to the administration in that bill, and said, just like this with the Rubik's Cube, and we said twist it and turn it, remodel it, do whatever you need to do until those squares lined up. Because I worked in the Clinton administration, and I know how hard it is when Congress passes a law and hands you a very scripted piece of legislation, and you got nowhere to go with it. So we specifically wrote this with the amount of flexibility that we believe the Secretary needed, all the flexibility she needed, to work with those parameters to be able to make it viable. And then, again, you're up against these assumptions that have been there for a long time. I have an email I was just talking about that I save on my email. And this shows me how conflicted people were, but conflicted enough that this conversation shouldn't start. Conflicted enough that we haven't finished the work on seeing what we can do to make this a better program or make it really work. Unless you really want the only game in town for you to continue to be Medicaid. So we take people who work their entire life and we say, we're going to make you poor enough and we're going to make you significant enough so you'll qualify for Medicaid, and then you got to fight your way out of an institutionally biased program. Right, so that the only thing really there, unless you get into one of the waivers that have waiting lists, is to be able to go to a nursing home. Okay, but that's what we do to people. I went to a bookstore. There are bound books that show you how to hide your assets so that you can get eligible for, how do we hide grandmom's assets to 8 years? What's the window now? I don't even know. But now we start 8 years ahead of time what we think grandmom's going to not be able to know what she's doing, and then we start hiding the assets. That is a very... very bad thing, I would argue. Senator Kennedy argued this country shouldn't be about that. Okay, and the long-term care insurance industry is about managing risk, not accepting risk. And that's their business model, and they're entitled to that. So what happens in between? And that's what this program was about. Okay, and again, there's no program in class. It was parameters to twist and turn. And then I'll share one other piece of it with you in terms of the politics, where that happened. We wanted to work very closely with the insurance industry. So when the bill was in Congress, we said, let's give the long-term care insurance industry tax credits. Let's go ahead and put a cafeteria plan in place for them. Let's let both of these things be sold together at the exchanges. Both the this is the politics part. Democrats and Republicans in the Congress knocked it out. We said, let's take the money and take it off budget, meaning that you put it almost in a lockbox so it can't be borrowed against. Both Democrats and Republicans ran down the aisle and said, take it out of that. We don't want you setting a precedent that we can't borrow money from programs. Turned around the next week and yelled Ponzi scheme. So I learned a lot through this whole process of watching those kinds of things. Those are the kinds of politics. We had the program as a voluntary opt-out. The insurance industry, particularly with two very important votes, said, no, 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 you can't have that because people won't know what they're doing. Okay, and they knew as soon as they were able to convince the voter not to do that, that it would make it very hard with the assumptions that we had, with the risk pool not being completely all healthy. So there were a lot of things where we started that got cut away. A lot of it had to do with politics. The 275 groups that to this day, God bless them, stand behind not letting this go, were up against the industry, big Wall Street industry, because if you peel all of it back, that's where it leads to. Okay, and they couldn't even come close to the amount of money that was spent lobbying against this by the industries that didn't want it. So it was an interesting thing to kind of watch. Where are we now? The politics now is even kind of more interesting and convoluted. Lots of things happen in healthcare reform. There are things included that are included knowing you're going to give them away later. There are deals cut behind the scenes that you don't know about. There's things called low-hanging fruit, things that don't belong to the core piece of healthcare. Your prevention is one of them. Class Act is another one. So those are the things that you need to watch. Because when those who wanted health care first entered into this, it was about two things. It was about insure the uninsured. That's what it was supposed to be. Insure the uninsured and set up exchanges that in some way mirror what a national health insurance would look like at the state level. Beyond that, everything else tended to be extra added attractions. So we argued, then call it a coverage bill. Don't call it health care reform, because that's a coverage bill. And we had lots of debates in the meetings about what to call it. So then as things progress and as you see where things are now, people want to protect that core. Whatever it takes to protect that core is important. Okay, this particular program, because of all the issues that were associated with it, you know, may have gone on the chopping block prematurely. We believe that the work of it in trying to figure out what to do with this issue wasn't completed. So now you have the administration who says, well, we really can't do it, even though they had an actuary that came from Genworth's insurance company to work with them, who actually came up with a way to do it. And people say, well, did you like what he did? Well, no, I don't. But he had tenants in there that you could play with. And if he had an idea, lots of other people had an idea. And so we're still fighting the fight. Now they're in a situation where they say they can't really do it, but they're not going to repeal it. So I said last week, what are you going to do? Put it in a trophy case and watch it? I mean, what do you do? But this is an opportunity. And I think it's an opportunity for everyone in this room and all of us who really care about this issue. You've got the left side of the page debating how to get the entitlement programs under control. That's Medicaid, the only game in town, essentially. And on the other hand, we have stopping our progress and trying to understand how to deal with this issue. It doesn't make sense. So this is an opportunity to say, let's continue the work for another period of time. Let's get the right people in a transparent way informing the conversation, like Josh, like others that are out there, and let's see where we end up. This is the third time in, 30 years, I guess, that we've tried to address that. Ross Minkowski tried, Clinton tried, and here we are again. And we should probably try to make it work. I was fortunate enough before I left the Senate, I was really fortunate, to send an email to Steve Jobs. And I just did it to do it. No one thought he would ever get back. And I sent him a copy of the bill and what it was, and I said, can you please just put your three smartest marketing guys on the phone? So because enrollment was going to be an issue. So everyone in the Senate said, oh, he'll never call you back. Well, he did. And he got on the phone, he set up a phone call, and he was on for maybe 2 minutes, you know, a very short period of time. Everyone said, why do you think he even responded? And I said, because he had a liver transplant. He's looking at this any which way. He's looking at this issue. So he did call back, and he said something that I don't know whether it's in a book yet. I haven't seen it since, but it might be. He said, new ideas are very hard, but you have to just keep going with them. And then he said, in reference to, I guess, a hockey person that he emulates or he likes, he said, you have to remember this. You don't look at where the puck is. You look at where it's going. And then he put his three marketing guys on the phone who were so smart that all of you would want to work there for a year. Because it really is a cool thing. And, you know, in terms of how do you market and how do you disaggregate populations, and it was fun. So I think we don't give up on this. I think we still fight the fight. I think we get the right minds to the table. But we also get the people in the neighborhoods who have to pay for this, who have to live like this, and who are entitled to some kind of dignity. As much as we talk about the aging end of things, I can tell you, I'm in there resuscitating newborns that aren't the Gerber baby every weekend, right? And I'm at the point now where I'm like, you know, God, I hope you have a life. I hope you go to school. I hope you get a job. I hope you have the supports you need to bring you to equal. Okay, we don't think about that because we don't really internalize that we don't know who we're going to be 24 hours from now. And there's no investment, and no one here knows that answer right now. So thank you all. If you all were supportive of it, we're going to fight the fight, and hopefully we'll come up with some solutions so people don't have to go on Medicaid as the only alternative if they don't qualify for the industry products. Thank you.
Thank you, Connie, and we'll get her back in a minute. So we're going to just leave her slide up because Josh is a last-minute fill-in, and so we don't have a name slide for him, but he won't be Connie Gardner. And I was just thinking, she was talking with Steve Jobs' marketing people, maybe instead of calling it LTCI, we should call it ILTC.
Yeah.
And on that, we'll give it to Josh.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Steve. I'm replacing John Wren, who was head of the class implementation office. He's now working from an undisclosed location. So what Steve asked me to do today is really try to put some of the class legislation into a historical context. Obviously, class did not spring out of nowhere. Came with a long history. So I want to review some of that and then give some observations on some of the things that Connie was bringing us towards. So I think, as everyone in this room knows, the basic thing that drives long-term care financing reform is that Medicare doesn't cover long-term care and private insurance generally doesn't cover it either. Maybe 10% of the elderly population have private long-term care insurance, and maybe 1 or 2% of the younger population. So that really drives everything else. Long-term care is expensive. It impoverishes a lot of people. People who end up using extensive long-term care have to spend down to Medicaid, end up on welfare, even if they've been financially independent all their lives. The delivery system has a strong institutional bias, even though people want home and community-based services instead. And even when we do offer home and community-based services, they're not necessarily the kinds of services that people want. And finally, we have this wave coming down the road or coming down the beach of the older or the baby boom generation who's aging. And frankly, we've got to find some way to get some more money into the long-term care financing system. So those issues have been with us forever. I mean, quite literally forever. But starting in the mid-1980s, there began to be a beginning of a private long-term care insurance market. For decades, actuaries had said there's no possible way long-term care can be an insurable risk. And then they saw the burning bush, and they changed their mind. And so in 1984, 85, 86, private insurers started rolling out various kinds of private long-term care insurance. Most of it at the beginning stunk. It had a variety of restrictions in it. It was very expensive. I started studying it in the mid-1980s, and I couldn't recommend it under any circumstance to anyone. As time went on, a lot of those restrictions went away, and the policies got better. But they still had a number of problems. They were expensive. Only maybe 10% of the elderly population could afford them. They continued to have certain kinds of restrictions, and they had medical underwriting. And even after sitting across the table with people who were selling insurance products, the insurance companies were excluding about 20% of people who were applying, even though those agents had been discouraging the obvious people with disabilities from applying. So we began to have a little bit of a market, but we still had major problems. And so in the late 1980s, there were a number of public long-term care insurance proposals. Virtually every Democratic senator or congressman who was a major player in healthcare had a bill. Senator Kennedy had a bill. Majority Leader George Mitchell had a bill. Ways and Means Committee Health Chair Pete Stark had a bill. Henry Waxman, who headed Energy and Commerce, had a bill. And there were a bunch of others as well. I've never quite figured out why 1989 should be the high point in the discussion of public long-term care insurance, but it sure as hell was. All were mandatory, all covered both institutional and home and community-based services, but there were three problems. One, none had any meaningful way of paying for these benefits. Two, none of them had any Republican support. And third, a deficit reduction was at the head of things, and George Herbert Walker Bush was president, and there was no way that this was going to get enacted. But there was a lot of discussion, and I wrote lots of papers about it. So Bill Clinton became president, and we made a major policy debate about healthcare reform, and although it was contentious within the administration, the Clinton bill did have a major long-term care component, which I always describe as a friend of public insurance. I call it a friend of public insurance because it wasn't an entitlement to services. It was a big pot of money for home and community-based services, and you had an entitlement to an assessment. But it would be up to the state, each state on its own, to figure out how to allocate these resources, which were to be provided on a needs basis, but not a means-tested basis. So it was independent of income and asset, and so it was trying to keep that kind of universal entitlement aspect, but it was not an insurance plan. And the design was highly influenced by advocates for younger people with disabilities. The disability advocates insisted that the benefits be for home care and not for institutional care, and so that's where the money went. And they insisted that the benefit have the greatest possible flexibility. As Connie very eloquently alluded to, people, younger people with disabilities, older people with disabilities, have very broad range of needs, and they didn't want a kind of narrow personal care option only covered. They wanted something very, very broad. So the conundrum in 1993 is you can't be entitled to everything. We can't have a list of things that covers everything. And so what we ended up with was this big pot of money, but no real entitlement to services. After health reform collapsed in the mid-1990s, and we had not too much happened. George W. Bush became president, and the national debate, such as it was, about long-term care was really away from the financing. There was no agreement about financing, as there is no agreement about financing now. And so the long-term care national debate was really about the delivery system, about shifting from institutional to home and community-based services, and developing more participant-directed, consumer-directed, home and community-based services. To the extent to which there was some kind of discussion about financing, it was mostly about providing tax incentives for private long-term care insurance. And though which the Bush administration endorsed in principle, but after bringing to Congress a couple of $1 trillion worth of tax cuts, it was not included. So Hawaii and Washington State became debated public insurance for long-term care and came pretty close to enacting it or implementing it, but they didn't. Private insurance continued to chug along, but it never had any breakthrough so that large numbers of people were going to have it. But internationally, Germany, the Netherlands, Austria, and England came up with a solution to the conundrum that had really vexed the Clinton long-term care plan, which was how do you have a very broad range of services without breaking the bank? And the answer was you give people a fixed dollar amount based on levels of disability, and you tell them to buy the kinds of services and other things that maximize their own utility. So that was beginning to be understood here in the United States. I and a number of other people wrote articles about the German long-term care insurance program that described how that kind of cash benefit worked. So the debate on health reform in the Obama administration, the CLASS Act seemed to be the vehicle to thread the needle that had vexed a lot of the previous efforts. As Connie alluded to, it wasn't central to providing health insurance to the uninsured, but it was very important to Senator Kennedy, and clearly there were a lot of people in Congress who wanted to take into account his last major effort. It was going to be voluntary, not mandatory, and while we can debate whether this is the appropriate model and whether a voluntary system can work, Medicare Part D, Medicare Part B have huge enrollments, 95% enrollment rates, and so I think Connie can tell me if that was a conscious model or not. The use of working and the 5-year waiting period was designed to be a substitute for medical underwriting and to try to address the adverse selection problem that you have with any kind of voluntary system. And there would be the cash benefit, as I've already mentioned, would give great flexibility, but with limited government liability, because at each level of disability, you've got a fixed dollar amount. So And finally, the low-income people and students would be subsidized to make it more affordable, but the cost wouldn't come from taxpayers. It would come from other people who had signed up for the program. So those were the basic efforts to, as I say, thread the needle. But the actuaries basically decided that that was not going to work. And that is really the heart of what is behind HHS's decisions. And what really, I think, come together are the problems of a non-mandatory program where you don't expect 90-95% of the population to enroll. And so in talking to actuaries, what they would say is that what they do is they start with the assumption that everybody who's disabled and everybody who has serious chronic illness is going to enroll, because it's always going to be beneficial to them to enroll. And the question is, how many non-disabled people can you get to enroll? And notwithstanding the Apple marketers, they're not going to enroll at a premium that is $150 or $230 a month, which is the kinds of premiums that the actuaries at HHS were grinding out at the time when they pulled the plug. So I think in the broader scheme of things, I think one of the things that we need to think about and we need to think hard about is there are a number of things, and they're in the report that HHS put out, that could have been done to make a voluntary program work. At least the people I talked to at HHS would dispute some of Connie's view that they had all the flexibility that they needed. I think they felt that they did not have the legal flexibility. But more broadly, there were a number of things in there designed to make the program work for younger people with disabilities, but drove up the cost. Lifetime benefits, a definition of working that was quite minimal and would allow a very substantial number of people with disabilities, at least in theory, to qualify. The cash benefit, all those things, the premium subsidy for low-income people, all those things are things you would kind of expect out of a public social program. That's, you know, nobody says for Medicaid you get covered for 3 years and then your benefit terminates. But that nobody says that for Social Security. And for most of Medicare, all putting aside the hospital benefit, nobody says you get 15 physician visits and that's it. So all those are kinds of things we kind of expect in our public programs. They meet the needs of the people who use them. But if you're asking people to pay premiums, they substantially add to the cost. So looking at private insurance, a lifetime benefit is 30% more expensive than a policy that covers only 5 years. Some estimates were that the premium subsidy would increase the premium by 50%. So all of those things kind of add together. And so, again, I come back to the question of can this kind of voluntary system work if there are all of these features that are really designed, as in many ways they should be, for younger people with disabilities. And the other question is, if we make those adjustments, we don't have the premium subsidy, we don't have lifetime benefits, we make the cash benefit not quite cash, because actuaries say that that's more expensive too. So it, you know, so the premium comes down. The product begins to look a lot more like private long-term care insurance. So one then asks, well, what is the social benefit then? Why is the government going to do it if it's going to look like private insurance? So those, I think, are some of the trade-offs and things for the future. I think for HHS, you know, if you had said to me 2 years ago that the political environment would be what it is today, there was no possible way I would have believed you. So who knows what the political environment will be 2 years from now. And I think if things change in a way that's more like what the administration would like, then I think what they would hope for are either some more explicit opportunities to waive various provisions and redesign things. But we always come back to, I think, those kinds of trade-offs that I alluded to. Thank you.
Thanks, Josh.